Hello, hello. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Good to see you. For everyone who doesn't know me, my name is Tim. I'm filling in for Mark and Ross in their absence. And I'm a member here at Paradoxes. It's good to be here. Good to see you all. I have some announcements today. So for all you wondering where Hugh Ross is, he's teaching in Hawaii right now, and he's going to be there for the next 3 weeks. So for today, we won't have him here. We'll be watching a video instead. It's from the Stars, Cells, and God series from RTB, featuring Jeff Zwiering, for those of you who know him. And the subject of today's video is UFOs and Christianity, and also asteroids making land. So kind of topical for anybody who's seen all the hubbub on the news. So Hugh's going to be back in 3 weeks on the 12th of March. And so after this week, for the next 2 weeks after this, we'll have a guest speaker, Dr. Cavolo, who is an associate pastor here at this church. He's going to be doing a four-part series, so two parts first, starting next week, and then the next two parts on April 30th and May 7th. And the subject of his talk is going to be about Abraham Kuyper, Prime Minister of the Netherlands, who was a very influential neo-Calvinist and a theologian and a journalist as well. So I'm interested, and hopefully you guys are too, in that talk. And the last order of business is Ross Hoagland asked me to tell a joke to continue with this new tradition. So pardon me, this is a physics joke. So excuse me if no one laughs. Here it goes. So three physicists are on a road trip, and they're sitting in the car. In the driver's seat is Heisenberg, and next to him is Schrodinger, and in the back is Ohm. And they're driving along, right, and they get pulled over. And so the cop asks Heisenberg, who's driving, you know how fast you were going? And Heisenberg says, no, but I know exactly where I am. The cop says, you were doing 55 in a 35. And Heisenberg throws up his hands in a fury and says, great, now I'm lost. The cop thinks this is suspicious and orders him to pop the trunk. The cop checks it out and says, oh my God, do you guys know you have a dead cat back here in the trunk? Schrodinger throws up his hands. We do now, you jerk. The cop moves in to arrest them. Ohm resists. Thank you. So, okay, I'm sure you can Google some of those if you don't know the physicists. All right. Thanks for putting up with me. And now for the video, I hope you guys enjoy. And we'll take some questions after, but since we don't really have an expert, I'm no expert by any means, we'll do our best to answer your questions. So ask away in the comments for those of you who are online. Anyways, enjoy.
Hello, welcome to Stars, Cells, and God, the show where we discuss new discoveries taking place at the frontiers of science and that have theological and philosophical implications, as well as new discoveries that point to the reality of God's existence. My name is Jeff Zwiering. I'll be your guide as we explore some philosophy topics about UFOs and how continents got started. Before we get into the discussion, though, I want to encourage you to subscribe to our channel, Reasons to Believe, so you can be notified of our new weekly videos. Learn more at reasons.org or by following us on social media at RTB_official. Well, it's good to be here today. Brian, I'm excited about our conversation today. If you could, just kind of give us a 20-second introduction. Who are you? What do you study? And what makes you interesting?
Okay. Well, I am from Charlotte, North Carolina. I currently live in Statesboro, Georgia. My academic background is in mostly philosophy. I have a master's in philosophy and PhD in philosophy of religion. I teach philosophy for Southern Evangelical Seminary and teach some homeschool classes for apologia. And I have three kids. Play guitar when I can a little bit. Used to play golf. just finished some work with the Air Force and did my research project on what they call UAPs, kind of like UFOs. And this is a pretty hot topic. There's a lot going on. Just did a church conference on this, doing a podcast tonight, even on Solomon's Corner about it. So it seems to be a pretty hot topic for some reason today.
Right. Well, let's go ahead and get into it. I know I agree with you. UFOs or UAPs now is what they're called. I assume you'll give us a little bit of background on that. Why don't you get us started? What do we need to know, or what's going on with those these days?
Well, you know, I always had a fascination, as I guess most people do, with backyard astronomy and the night sky. And so as a kid, I was into that. I've always kind of liked UFOs just as a general interest, I guess. But when the New York Times in 2017 broke the story about the Navy pilots capturing these videos of these, what we're just going to call UFOs or UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. And the Pentagon said, yeah, these are legitimate videos. I actually read Hugh Ross's book, Lights in the Sky in the Green Minute, and Ken Samples and Mark Clark's book. And that kind of kicked off a real interest for me about these things, because he was quoting people, this is a real word, ufologists, people who study things all about UFOs, ufology. And so I started reading a la their book, people like Jacques Vallée and J. Allen Hynek and things. And it was interesting because they were saying this is a real legitimate thing. And you think about UFOs, you think about people who are kind of kooky and weird. And one of the things that I learned through my studies is that, yeah, a lot of people are seeing these, and they're across all spectrums of education, politics, socioeconomic background all over the world. That's like going way back into human history. And it's interesting. So I just started my project 2 years ago. And within that time, the U.S. has started, the Pentagon started a UAP task force. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence came out with a preliminary assessment that was pretty much directed them to do that by Donald Trump. And then this past July, we had our first open congressional hearing in the past 50 years on the topic. So there's a lot of interest and interweaving on UFOs from the military, from the national security side. And then there's of course, a whole nother, no pun intended, dimension of the topic when we get into things like the occultic issue or spiritual issue. Right. And so there's a lot of different ways we can look at this. Aliens, and so the podcast from tonight is, well, if aliens did exist, would that in any way affect Christianity? What would that mean? Because right. People have said that if there are aliens, and that would be, to use their words, a real faith shaker. Well, should right. it be? I don't think it should, and there's no reason I don't think to believe in aliens per se, but there's a lot going on with the topic today.
Well, very good. So why don't you, can you give us a brief description? Because I know UFOs, everybody seems to know what that term means, but this UAP, is there a fundamental reason for that new terminology? Or
yeah, it's kind of funny because normally ufology in the United States kind of kicks off around 1947 when Ken Arnold saw his famous sighting around Mount Rainier, Washington, and he said he saw nine what later became known as discs and just known as flying saucers. Mm-hmm. Then the term flying saucer kind of became pejorative, and like, well, that's just a flying saucer. So in the early 1950s, the person running the Air Force Project Blue Book, Edward Ruppelt, actually coined the term. He says he coined the term UFO. I think he pronounced it UFO, actually. Now they're calling it UAP. It means the same thing. Okay. Unidentified aerial phenomena or anomalous phenomenon. I think it is trying to make it seem a little bit less pejorative in that regard. But yeah, it means the same thing. And it's funny because it's the military who keeps changing the terminology as time goes by.
So what are the actual phenomena? Or I mean, what have you found in your research, and what do we need to know in thinking about these?
Okay. So about 95% or so roughly of what are seen or reported are very explainable through natural phenomena, weather, people looking at actual technology that's secret. In fact, the Air Force has used UFOs as a cover for their own technology. But there's about 5% or so, and in years past, it's been as high as about 25% that are truly unidentified. We don't know what they are. But they're seeing all kinds of things like discs, or what we would consider just flying saucers, tic-tac looking things. They come in all shapes, square, triangle, circle. They can change their shape, change their color. They come in and out of a field of view instantaneously, almost just vanishing. They have all kinds of appearances and looks and speeds and that sort of thing. But yeah, it is real. People are seeing them across the world and way back into human history. It didn't start with the 20th century. It goes hundreds of years back. From what historians of the phenomena tell us. But yeah, there is a real aspect to it. We can't just wave it off as simply natural. Most of it's natural, but there's a small component that is not explainable in that regard. And even our military has come out saying, yeah, there are these things. We don't know what they are. They're not ours. We don't think they're anybody else's, like China's or anything like that. So they don't know what they are either. At least that's what they're saying.
So let's kind of stick with that 95%. You know, mentioned sometimes it's Venus. Are these dominantly people see with their eyes, or is this a lot of this instruments on a plane or on a ship? Or, I mean, is there any sense you have of the distribution of what people are actually seeing, or what the actual the detection is, if you will?
Yeah, there's different what now we're calling sensors. So there are a lot of people who are just seeing them with their naked eye, and then there are radar reports. As radar was becoming more and more available, more and more radar were seeing these things. For example, there was a 1952 flap. A flap is a term used in ufology to describe a lot of UFO activity in one spot, or a lot of things going on all at the same time. And there was one over Washington, D.C., of all places, 1952, which kind of pushed the CIA to get involved. And they were seen by the pilots with their eyes. They were seen with radar. They're detected by various sensors, multiple at the same time in some cases. So yeah, it's not just the eye. It's not just the radar either. It's pretty much just a pretty good swath of different ways of seeing it and detecting it.
And so, I mean, do these tend to be all at night? I know I've had a couple of talks, and you know, they're just when you do enough stuff in the air or whatever, you tend to see unusual circumstances and unusual you know, that's what leads the identified flying object. I know at least one of them I saw was, you know, gas jets off of a offshore oil rigs. You know, they just give odd phenomena because of atmospheric effects. Do they tend to happen at all times of day, at night?
They happen all times of day, but the preponderance of sightings are at night. If you read John Keel, he's a well-known, not only ufologist, but kind of a paranormal investigator, kind of reason. He passed away a few years ago. But he argues that the preponderance of sightings are actually on Wednesday's night around 10 o'clock and Saturday evening. But if you read Jacques Vallée and other people, they'll say, yeah, this is normally at night, late at night. And there's different theories as to why that would be. One is you just can see things in the sky better at night if they're lit up. And these aren't just reflecting light. They're actually luminous, giving off their own light a lot of times. Really? And there's lots of theories as to why that would be. People are looking up. People are out at those times. But they do. They are seen in the day. So Hynek, the astronomer from Ohio who worked with the Air Force, categorized these different kinds of sightings like daylight disks or nocturnal lights. And all the close encounters as well. But yeah, they're seen all the time, but mostly at night.
So my perception, you know, is I don't spend a lot of time looking into this, but, you know, every now and again, I'll investigate it. Obviously, people ask me questions. And, you know, it seems like there's a lot more of these phenomena that are being talked about, where there seems to be good video evidence of a, you know, like a trapezoidal pyramid that's floating around in the air or something like that. What do you make of stuff like that? Is this, are we seeing actual alien ships, or is this military or something other? It seems a little bit too geometric to be just some random phenomena out there, if you will.
Yeah. We have seen all kinds of shapes. We've seen, like, as you just mentioned, triangles, rectangles, squares, circles, you pretty much name it, ovals, cigar-shaped looking things. And some people are seeing military aircraft. The F-117, for example, that's triangular in shape, was the cause of a lot of UFO reports. Mm-hmm. But what are they? So there's various theories as to what these things could be. One of them would be military aircraft. And then when you start looking at the ones that are doing things that seem to defy physics, where they don't seem to be physical, they're going at hundreds, if not thousands of miles per hour and performing right angle or 180 degree angle turns, mm-hmm. going through different mediums like water, air, and space with like there's nothing there, disappearing, changing the shape from one thing to something else, morphing into various things. That lends to other theories besides there being actual physical objects, as for example, he or Rossar used in his book or their book. Of course, the kind of automatic knee-jerk reaction, well, if it's not terrestrial, it's got to be extraterrestrial, meaning aliens.
Right.
And there's arguments that people use for that. And there are a lot of good arguments that seem to indicate that that's probably not what's going on. And there's a whole nother aspect to this issue that seems to be spiritual in nature. Interestingly, some of the top ufologists like Hynek, historian Jerome Clark, John Keel, argue that they're not really even physical objects. They're more psychic in nature, not just in the mind, but that they can manifest their immaterial, or as Keel says, paraphysical kind of things that can manifest as physical objects, much like we see with poltergeist type activity. There's a lot of similarities and connections between UFO alien type things and very occultic paranormal type behavior. So the other, if you want to get into what the arguments on both sides, there are arguments people use for aliens, and there's arguments that seem to make that very problematic.
So, I mean, yeah, when you're dealing with poltergeist ghosts, that's something I've always kind of classified as, I don't know, not real, not physical phenomena, mm-hmm. kind of interesting things that people see that they're adding more to, or are we talking about actual physical phenomena here? Or, I mean, how do we think about that? What's going on here, actually?
With the UFOs?
Yeah, you know, you said there's these things that may be non-physical but have physical manifestations.
Yeah. So if you're looking at them, you think you're seeing a physical thing, but there's characteristics about how they fly, how they operate, how they maneuver that seems to indicate that they're really not physical. And again, these are some of the people who have really studied these issues at the highest levels, like Hynek, Keel. Valet thinks they're physical, but they go between dimensions. They sometimes make it on radar. They what was called paint on radar. They should show up on radar. They don't break. They don't oftentimes have any sound. Where they should break the sound barrier. They should have a sonic boom. They should, you would think, shatter or kill anything inside of it if they're performing a right angle or 180 degree turn at an incredible high rate of speed, and just vanishing and disappearing. These kinds of things make it seem like they're really not physical, or being miles over there, as Commander Fraser in the Navy said, and then instantaneously being miles over there, mm-hmm. where they're going. These kind of things make it where it seem like they're not very really physical. The counter to that is, well, they have some kind of knowledge about physics that we haven't gained yet.
Okay.
But when you couple that with other aspects of the issue, like the poltergeist type thing, and like the very anti-Christian aspects of these alleged alien encounters and just the phenomenon in general, it really doesn't seem like it's alien or even physical. Even the alien abduction experiences don't seem to be really physical in nature. Okay. Now, they do leave physical traces, so they can cause manifestations that are physical. They can leave radiation behind. They can leave impressions. They can break tree limbs, for example. Like they can cause depressions. It looks like there was a triangular landing gear, for example. They can cause physical effects on cars, or electromagnetic effects, or even biological effects. People have been known to die in these mm-hmm. in these encounters. So they can certainly have these kind of manifestations. And we already know that non-physical beings can cause or bring about physical manifestation. We see this in the Bible with angels, for example.
Right.
They can materialize or bring about material effects.
So we've moved over into that kind of 5% that no longer have a physical explanation at some level, saying that these are now not just physical phenomena. There's got to be something more. And this is where you get the kind of poltergeist, UFO, or alien type explanation. I'm assuming you don't think that's the right way to think about it. What is your assessment of what these things are when you're not dealing with the ones that have physical, that behave physically the way they're supposed to?
Yeah. So you look at this much in the same way you would the resurrection, for example. You say, okay, well, here's the different theories. Which theory gives us the most explanatory power? That is, how well do these theories explain the data? What has the best explanatory scope? How much of the data is explained? What's the most plausible? What's the least amount of ad hoc or just kind of made up to save the day, regardless of any kind of evidence? Mm-hmm. And so we have these different theories. One, of course, is the extraterrestrial hypothesis, the ETH. Another well-known one is Vallée's view, which is you go through, these things are here. They're not extraterrestrial in an alien sense. They're physical, but they can go through the various physical dimensions. And that would kind of explain, according to Vallée, why they can maneuver the way they do and kind of pop in out of existence as they do.
Okay, there's physical dimensions near us that we don't have access to, and somehow these beings can cross between those dimensions.
That's what Vallée is saying.
What Vallée is saying, okay.
Yes. Now, and I'm not an astronomer or a physicist, but so going back, leaning on Hugh Ross, for example, he says that's an interesting theory, and I know Hugh Ross does believe in these various dimensions, as a lot of physicists do, but according to him, once you start looking at the theories of relativity, you're pretty much locked into one dimension. You can't just go in and out mm-hmm. of these various dimensions.
Right.
And I think that Vallée has some really good points to make, especially with pointing out the problems of the alien view, because there are a lot of problems with that view. I don't think his answer has the best explanatory scope, because it doesn't really answer why there's this spiritual kind of paranormal, occultic, and even very anti-Christian, not just anti-religious, but anti-Christian dimension to it. And if you look at the research of various people, like, for example, Joe Jordan, he is a director of a MUFON chapter. MUFON stands for Mutual UFO Network.
Okay.
And they are, I think, the leading civilian UFO research group.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs the one out in South Korea, and he's done a lot of research and have hundreds of people saying that when they're having this, what seems like an alien abduction experience, when they call the name of Christ, the abductions stop, which is interesting, because UFO researchers said there's nothing you can do to stop these experiences. Well, he started talking to other people at MUFON about this, and they said, well, yeah, we know that, but we can't talk about it because it's religious, so you can go research it and publish, and he has. His book is called Piercing the Cosmic Veil, You Shall Not Be Afraid of the Terror by Night. And the word terror is very appropriate, because it is very terrifying for these people who are experiencing these things. And also, the teachings from these alien beings are just inherently anti-Christian. They talk about Christ not being divine, or having all these very anti-Christians. We take all this together, and not just starting at 1947, looking at the military aspect of it. If you look at the whole history and the whole picture of ufology around the different countries around the world, going back centuries, if you look at the big picture, it doesn't seem like that the alien view, to use Vallée's terminology, is one, strange enough, or it answers all the phenomena. And Vallée does a really good job of pointing out that there's a lot of similarities between these alleged alien encounters and the other religious views around the world, like the fairy faith, for example, around Ireland and in other places around the world, that connects to their own culture and worldviews. I used to wonder, why would a demon, for example, if it's what we're looking at, that's just one view, why would a demon want to make us think that there are aliens? And other people, like Vallée, who's not a Christian, are saying because they want to. They are very deceitful, and Keel says this as well, very not a Christian at all. And they want to control our thoughts, our worldview, and our beliefs. That would be a great reason for a demon to do that, if that's what we're seeing, because that does change our worldview if they can do it through that kind of means.
Well, and it's a very interesting statement, because, we're talking about stuff that we're largely seeing, or that a lot of the records are more recent, within the last few hundred years, if you will.
Right.
You go back into scripture, and there's these repeated admonitions against, no spirit, no demonic spirit will ever say that Christ is the Savior, and so your description aligns with what scripture said thousands of years ago. This behavior we're seeing seems to align. I guess it kind of goes to your question there of, what are the different models out there for doing that? It seems like the Christian demonic spiritual model has a lot of explanatory power in accounting for the phenomena that we see.
Yeah, I think so. I think it does a good job of explaining the data that we're seeing, explains it well. So it's got scope and power. Getting these terms from people like Habermas and Lacan when they do the resurrection theory. It's the same kind of framework.
Right.
Also, we can see this in David McCullough, for example, or C.P. McCullough on his book on philosophy of history. But it's just the same kind of way of exploring and evaluating theories. The way it does seem like it takes everything into consideration, and it does a good job of explaining the apparent physical phenomena as well as the spiritual phenomena.
So I want to go back to a comment you made. You were discussing there and about how if one of the fellows looking at this noticed that when you name the name of Christ, that the abductions, the encounters disappear. And the comment from the other fellow was, "Well, that's religious. I can't investigate that." Why not? It seems like you now have this physical phenomena that's affecting what's going on. Why? What was the reason for not being able to include that in the
I
investigation?
don't know if he said that, and it's weird because you're talking about things that are, UFOs are they're seen usually as not a normal thing. We can talk about aliens, but not God and the Bible. That's just weird. I guess because it would be offensive or turn people off is just my guess, and it's kind of a taboo way of being able to go about looking at it. But if we're just trying to follow the evidence, I mean, why not have this kind of this door that we can look at or walk through and see where does the evidence point? And his name is Joe Jordan. Joe Jordan is just he's just amassed this great amount of evidence that what we're seeing is not alien, and there's again various reasons for that, but it seemed like it is very spiritual in nature. These beings walk through walls. The participants who are being abducted also are taken through walls. There are instances where someone is abducted and they're in a room with other people and they don't leave the room. They kind of go unconscious, like they're in a trance-like state. And they say, "Yeah, we went to a spaceship." Well, they didn't go in a spaceship. They were right there in the living room the whole time. So there's very much this kind of psychological, not merely psychological, but psychological and spiritual aspect to the phenomena that these other theories just they're too simplistic. They don't look at the history of the issue, and they don't explain all of these data points, like the fact that they do things that are very anti-physical seemingly, and also this whole spiritual aspect of it is just ignored by a lot of folks. Interestingly, not by Vallée. He has a whole book called "Messengers of Deception," and he and John Keel again, who are not Christians, who are saying these are very deceitful type beings who are trying to deceive us, to control us, to play tricks on us, and lead us astray. Well, it's really interesting. They come so close to the demonic view. They even use the terms demons and spiritual, and things like that. They just don't connect it to actual demonic or evil spiritual forces in the same regard that we would. They're really close, but they don't quite get there. They have good reasons for rejecting the alien view, and they support our view that these probably are very just evil and deceitful type beings who are very anti-Christian.
One last question, and then I'll let you have the last word, kind of wrap up our discussion here. A while back, you go back to the comments you make, how these things can fly through the air, supersonic. Why is it that they have the visual component of what's going on, but not like the auditory or sensory? I mean, is that a common thing, or is that just I only heard a part of what you were saying?
It's very common for these objects that are seemingly flying around to not have any noise. Sometimes they do cause noise, but they oftentimes don't. And we can only speculate as to why that would be. It does tend to lean toward the view again that they're not really physical. That might be part of the deception because they think, well, if it's not having a noise, it's nothing like what we would have. If it made noise, it would make it seem more normal, maybe. And if it doesn't have this noise, maybe it does seem more alien. That's just a speculation. I don't know. But it is very normal for these things, whether they're going slow or fast, to not have any kind of sound. Now, sometimes they do, but most of the time they don't.
Any final comments you want to have before we move on to our next topic?
Well, I guess just be careful. I'm going to use John Keel here. He's again is not a Christian, and he says If you get too far interested into these topics and go down the rabbit trail too far, it can be dangerous. You can be lured into these very dark corners. There was someone who sent me a book. His name is Joe also. He was glad the book is over on the UFO topic. And I asked him why, because it's very dark. It is very dark. Marcia Montenegro wrote a book and has written a lot about the kind of seduction of paranormal activity, not to rip off someone else's title there, but the paranormal area, I guess, of life. And it tends to suck us down that road, and we get trapped in it. So just we need to be aware that these things are real and that they're actually are dangerous, because people are having these experiences where it does take the name of Christ and the gospel to get them out of it. So we just be careful dabbling in it, but we need to be aware of the situation. We need to understand what the true nature of it is, and this is a great apologetic means to point us to Jesus. We can use this as actually an apologetic tool to point us to the truth of the gospel.
We're going to shift gears from UFOs or UAPs into something, I guess, a little more tangible and physical, or at least that we know is physical. And I was reading an article not too long ago about the origin of the continents. And this, it kind of struck me as odd because, everybody knows that we've got this Earth that's got seven continents, and there's the two Americas, North, South America. You got Europe, Asia, you got Africa, you got Australia and Antarctica. And I love how the vast majority of those start and end with the same letter, if you get rid of the North and South. I always found that just from a word game fascinating. But we've got these continents that are critical to life. I mean, you look at life here on Earth, and well over two-thirds of Earth's life lives either on the continents or on the continental shelves. And so just critical in Earth's capacity to host life, or the thriving diverse array of life that we have here on Earth. And I kind of found it interesting to recognize that the origin of the continents is actually something that it's not like this weird mystery, if you will, but it's something that we don't have a real good handle, say, okay, this is what we think is going on. And one of the ideas that has been out there for how you get continents started, and the interesting feature about continents that I have found, is that continents are rocks. I mean, they're the mountains, they're the stuff you think, okay, this is the heavy, dense stuff. And it turns out that when you look at the crust of the Earth, there's the ocean crust and then the continental crust. The continental crust is kind of the light and buoyant stuff that floats up on top. It's the lighter rocks. It's rocks that have been processed and have less density, and so they float on top. And so typically, once the continents have been formed, they tend to stick around for a long time. I mean, they'll be eroded, but most of that material gets put back onto the crust. But the idea that we didn't know where they started was something kind of interesting to me. And one of the ideas that has been out there is that the collision of asteroids with the Earth early in its history was what started the process of continent formation. I thought, now that's interesting if that turns out to be true, because, and the idea here is you've got miles to hundreds of miles wide asteroids that come in and collide. There's an enormous amount of energy deposited in the Earth. It some If enough of these happen, you can kind of liquefy the surface of the Earth, the rock surface of the Earth. You get this magma ocean, and miles deep. But as we know that when, from an astronomy perspective, when we look back at the history of our solar system, somewhere between 4.2 and 3.8, 3.7 billion years ago, there seems to be a lot of evidence for a high degree of bombardment. We see it on Mercury, we see it on the Moon, we see evidence of impacts on the Earth, some of the more massive ones on the Earth, around that time scale. And the idea, the continent, or how that relates to the continents, is that when these collision, or when these asteroids come in, they disrupt the crust of the material. They cause a lot of melting. They eject a lot of debris, And that could actually be the process that starts the process of continent formation. So you're going to excavate material so the pressure releases. That's going to melt mantle underneath that area so that now you've got mantle that can now connect up with the continent. It's going to fracture the crust, which means water from the ocean is going to be able to get in and process the crust. And that process continues on. It just now adds the physical mechanisms, add ways for more crust, continental crustal material to be added on to this nucleus that was formed during the impact. Now, the reason why this idea hasn't been widely spread as, this is how continents formed, is that there just hasn't been a lot of evidence excavated or found that would support it. And that's kind of true of most continent origination models, is it's hard to get the data because most of the continents that were formed within that first billion years of Earth's history. And there's just not a lot of it that's left around that's easily accessible, or it's all been reprocessed into other materials. But what this group of researchers did was went down into Australia, into the Pilbara Craton, which is one of these very old segments of crust. And they started looking through the crust, and there are zircons in this old crustal material that they can now use to start investigating, is there any evidence for this impact model of what caused the continents to start? And what they found is in the zircons, they found three different stages of zircons, in particular in regard to one aspect, the amount of oxygen 18. So oxygen comes in three different isotopes. It comes oxygen 16, oxygen 17, oxygen 18. And the amount of the different isotopes gives indication of where the oxygen originated from. And we know the amount of oxygen, the oxygen 18 ratios for the mantle, that sits around 5 or so in the units they use. And what they were able to do is look at these zircons and found that, lo and behold, the oldest zircons actually had a oxygenation level that was much lower than that. So it was very low. And what that's evidence of is, instead of being brought up from the mantle, what you have is, in this original impact, what would happen is it would cause a lot of processing by the oceanic water and this crust that was there, and it would actually remove that oxygen 18 isotope, enrich it in the oxygen 16. And so you're going to have submantle oxygen 18 isotopes. And that's what they found in the zircons. The oldest zircons actually had that, which indicates that the original phases of continent building actually occurred much higher, or the material for it started much higher on the surface of the Earth. And then they found the newer zircons actually have much more mantle levels of oxygen 18, these oxygen 18 isotopes, which indicates that once this nucleus of the crust was formed, or the continent was formed, it was now built up or added to by material underneath. And then the youngest zircons actually have evidence of a much higher oxygen 18 ratio, which is evidence of supercrustal. And that's just a fancy term for material that's added on top of the crust. So these are like sedimentary igneous rocks that have maybe have gone through metamorphosis and been added into the continents. And so this picture is that you have an impact that fractures the surface of the Earth, melts it, gets the process started. The ocean water that gets into the cracks and fractionated separates things out, causes reactions that make it less dense, that now upwells. It brings new mantle material up so that that new mantle material melts and then coalesces around the nucleus, makes the continent larger. Things drip off, and then there's a little more involved in that process. And then ultimately, later on, more material is added onto the continent through just subduction and volcanic eruptions and other things like that. And so the key feature, though, is that these oxygen 18 isotopes show that the initial stages of the continent formation happen very near to the Earth's surface, which is what you would expect exactly what you would expect in this impact scenario. And from an astronomy perspective, I think, okay, if that scenario plays out, and I think there's a growing body of evidence supporting that, that one, you kind of have a better understanding of how continents form, which is just fascinating in all sorts of ways, because, you know, the idea that we're looking at these small diamond-like zircons that were formed 4 billion years ago, 3.8 billion years ago, 3.2 billion years ago, and getting information on how the continents form, I think it's just really cool that humans are ingenious enough to figure stuff out like this. But if this is correct, then asteroidal bombardment is going to be important for continental formation, because Earth is the only continent or only planet in our solar system that has continents. It may very well be the only planet of all the ones that we've discovered that has continents if you need this bombardment activity, because there was this, you know, probably a late heavy bombardment, whether it was really heavy or not, you know, that's open for discussion. But it was clear there was this period where Earth had a lot of bombardment. And not only did that seem to start the process of continent formation, but the way that happened in our solar system cleared out a lot of the debris so that this bombardment happened a lot very early. And now it's about 1,000 times less than what it would have been. So we're now living in an era where the asteroids and comets that would hit the Earth are 1,000 times less frequent than they otherwise would have been. And so this era where the late heavy bombardment happened, not only did it clear out and make it amenable for life much later because there's fewer bombardments, but it seems to be part of the process that started the formation of continents, which is also critical for life. And so I think this just kind of adds to an already very strong body of evidence that Earth is, it's like it's got a purpose. It's designed, it's fine-tuned to host life, and we're just seeing more and more evidence come forth to support that idea. So I'm curious, you know, as you're listening there, Brian, what sort of, does that stir any thoughts, or how do you respond to hearing scientific discoveries of that nature? I think you're muted.
One thing that struck me as you were saying all that was, yeah, it's really interesting that we have the ability to study all this. And from what I remember, people like Hugh saying is that we're in a unique place in our galaxy and universe to be able to study the rest of the universe. And so the fact that we can even study all this, to me, is really interesting. And it just goes to show how unique Earth is. People are saying, you know, maybe we discover life on other planets and things. And as Hugh and Fuzz like to say, we're a very unique planet. We're a very unique in a very unique kind of galaxy, and near a unique star. And so I think it does point out just how special this place is, and how God has put us here for a specific reason. There's just a lot of stuff. I don't know anything about the continental stuff you're talking about. Sounds really interesting and cool.
Well, it one of the things that I found fascinating in this is that, you know, I've talked a lot about the late heavy bombardment. And then, you know, again, that's this era where when you look at how the solar system formed, there's this graphic that I used to illustrate this, is that it's got a picture of, you know, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus in that order. You notice that Neptune and Uranus are backwards there. And you've got the sun, and they're all in these kind of compact orbits. And there's this dense cloud of asteroid comet type debris out there that's left over from the process of planet formation. Well, as Jupiter and Saturn migrate, they move in and out and they get into resonances. And there's this kind of rapid change where the things get kind of chaotic, or, you know, look a little chaotic for a while. And then you end up on the far right panel where now you've got Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune in the right order. Their orbits are much larger. And that debris cloud that's around there, it's where it's just this dense ring in the early image, it's just kind of scattered debris, little bits and pieces here and there. And I always thought, you know, that's interesting that happened very early in Earth's history, because if it happened now, well, that would just be catastrophic to life. I mean, having, you know, mile wide, 10 mile wide things hit the Earth, those are extinction level events, you know, so just, you're going to wipe life out. And so I always thought, you know, that had to happen early in Earth's history so that it couldn't happen later. this discovery, if this is ultimately the explanation, and I'm not going so far as to say, oh, we figured out how continents form, this is the explanation, but this seems to provide a fair bit of evidence in support of this being the proper explanation. If that's correct, now not only do we have to clear that stuff out, we need to have enough of those asteroid collisions to start continent formation, but not so much that later on in Earth's history, you're going to have these catastrophic collisions that wipe out life. And so rather than it being it just needed to happen early, it needs to happen late enough that the continents can form. It needs to happen sufficiently large enough that continents can form, and sufficiently early that it doesn't wipe out subsequent life. And so rather than just be, oh, it's got to happen early enough, no, it needs to happen kind of in this range with this level of magnitude in order to get Earth to be as habitable as it is. And so, there was just more design in that than I was even aware of, and this seems to illuminate it even more.
Yeah, it's interesting that things that you don't even think about like that, the people like me who don't know anything about this kind of aspect of asteroids or continent formation, it's just things that we don't even consider have to be so precise for our life here. It's just, I guess, one more notch on the design meter, I guess, if I can mix metaphors a little bit, yeah, on the stick of design level.
Well, I find it interesting because I tend to be a little slow to adopt new information, if you will. And what I mean by that is, like with the late heavy bombardment, I'm like, okay, it had to happen early enough. I don't know whether it had to happen, whether there's other ways, but could have happened earlier, could have happened, a billion years later, we'd have still been okay. And so it's like, okay, if it hadn't happened, it would be problems today. I know there's strong evidence for that. Whether it was any more tuned than that, I'll kind of leave open for future possibilities, but I'm only going to kind of stick with this. And I seem to be increasingly encountering areas where what I thought was, okay, there's this minimal level and I'm okay with that, but I don't know whether I want to push it harder. It turns out that I could actually push it much harder. And the evidence has come in later to support that, yeah, there is a lot more evidence for the design or fine tuning. And so I tend to be a little bit of a minimalist in terms of adopting fine tuning. Hugh tends to be a little bit more of a maximalist in my assessment, but either way, the evidence showing up for the fine tuning is pretty phenomenal. I find it very remarkable.
It's mind boggling. Yeah. From everything that Fudd is doing on a biochemical level and Hugh on the cosmological level. And then this is just, it's so much evidence that there had to be such precise conditions that the chance of it being merely from chance is essentially zero.
Well, and to go back to our earlier discussion, I mean, if we see this level of fine tuning and design here on Earth, just even within our solar system, but I expect, I mean, yeah, there's a boatload of planets out there, 100 billion just in our galaxy alone that are going to be Earth-sized. I'm not so sure that the idea flows from that, just because there's so many, we're going to find life out there. We seem to find a lot of things that need to be true of Earth in order to support life. And if it's so rare or fine-tuned here on Earth, the idea of all these unidentified aerial phenomena or any of those being related to aliens, even independent of the challenges of traveling from a distant planet here, it seems to me that I don't think we're going to find life out there, at least looking at it just from a naturalistic perspective. Whether God created life out there, that's a whole different question in my book.
That's right. And it is kind of for a normal, a non-specialist like me in those kinds of areas. The universe is so incredibly vast. We're kind of narrow-minded to think we're the only ones here. But when you start looking at these data, about everything that you've mentioned and what Hugh has to say, everything has to be so exactly precise that the chances are minimal. And it's even interesting that people like Jacques Vallée say that from a naturalist point of view, we have these aliens that most of them look anatomically like us, with the head and arms and legs. He says that this from a naturalist point of view, from an evolutionary point of view, the chances of just random naturalistic evolution giving rise to these other beings that somewhat look like us is essentially zero from a non-Christian. Now, of course, if you add theism, it might make that different, but just from a straight naturalist point of view, We've got people who are not Christians saying, yeah, evolution is not going to allow other kind of beings that look anatomically like us.
You know, that's an interesting point, because, you know, if all the aliens look more or less like us, what that essentially says is there's not too many ways you can have advanced organisms, or, you know, at least human-like organisms.
That can work, yeah. And it goes beyond just the look and the anatomical structure, but the ability to see in a certain spectrum and hear and the way the body works. It's just not going to happen on a naturalist point of view. Now, there are a number of different species of aliens that people look at. Some are reptilian, some are... They're really different and weird. But a lot of the times we see this kind of similarity with us.
Yeah, well, and that's what I found interesting, is because there's part of the idea out there, okay, wherever you get water, life's just going to adapt to whatever the conditions are,
right?
Which would lead to this expectation that everything would look very, very different. But if everything looks kind of like us, that says, all right, maybe it's not true that all the conditions out there life just adapts to, that you got to have these very specified conditions. So even just this similarity, I think that's probably a lot more a reflection of we're creating or you know, that there's something related to our psychology that goes on with aliens. Mm-hmm. But if that's indeed true, that seems to lead to this counterintuitive, or you know, either life doesn't just adapt to whatever the environment is, or more, it's like, no, there's only a few ways this works, and without those conditions, it's not going to work. And both of those seem to point towards a theistic perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I agree. Yep.
Well, thanks, Brian. Really enjoyed our conversation today. It's been fun talking about UFOs and UAPs and looking at continents and stuff. You know, I would just encourage everybody, if you've enjoyed this episode of Stars, Cells, and God, to check back each week. We release a new episode. Go to reasons.org. You can get a lot of information there. Be sure to share this video with a friend. And remember, the more we know about science, the more we have reasons to believe.
Ready, Mark? Okay. So that was a really interesting video. We're going to do kind of a question. The question and answer this time will be more of a, like, I was changing my pages. So the questions, we'll take any questions. We'll try to answer anything. None of us are real authoritarians on this subject. But we also want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on some of the things? I've got a couple facilitating questions that might help. First of all, do you have any questions for Mark, me, or Mark, and me? Or we didn't get any questions online yet either. So I thought of a couple questions. If aliens do exist, do you think it would affect Christianity and how people view Christianity in this world? What are your thoughts on that? Does anybody have any thoughts? Would it affect your faith in Christ? Would it affect your faith in Christ? Okay. Yep. He beat you to it.
I've heard it postulated, the question which comes to my mind. It's really more of another question rather than an answer to that. And might be, did Jesus die on another planet as well? I think that would be necessary, and I think that amplifies the improbabilities once again because of the uniqueness of many things. The question I would have is, how many college graduates, if we took an interview, I think it might be an interesting study, is to ask them what they think the prerequisites are for life, and how many of them would think that there's more than the water being liquid as necessary. From what I've been able to glean through different things, not many, even science majors, not that many realize how many things have to line up, a whole lot.
Okay, so, yes. Oh, yes.
Well, first of all, if they go through the spiritual world and accept, atheists, if they accept that there's a spiritual element to it, then they can start looking into that side of, can aliens be demonic? But if they're in denial, then no matter how much evidence there is, they're not going to believe it unless they personally experience it themselves in that dark, fearful world that Dr. Hugh Ross has mentioned, that if you're in that demonic realm and you come across that, there's a lot of fear. And in Jesus, there is no fear. So he acknowledges that, that you don't want to be in that realm and you don't want to tamper with the whole sorcery and the witchcraft. You don't want to be in that world because it's very scary, dark world. And, you know, there has to be a place where people who study science have to look at all the choices out there. They can't say, well, we're not going to study the spiritual, but we'll study this and this parts. But no, you got to look at everything. You got to look at every single possibility out there before you come to a conclusion.
Okay. That's a good thing. I'm wondering if they will study anything spiritual, because science studies the physical world, right? But they are talking about multidimensionality, so can they study that? I would like to go back to, I hear you. I'll get to you in a second. I got another question that kind of plays off yours. If there's aliens on another planet in this universe, would Jesus be obligated to die for their sins? In the sense that, is he obligated to die for the sins of angels, fallen angels, or whatever? So, I don't know. Just that might be something to think about.
Jesus died once and for all. So that means all. If there truly are other inhabitants of other planets, he died for all. So if they are really aliens, which I really doubt, if they're demonic, that's a whole nother story. But he shouldn't have to go to every planet and die for, you know, the inhabitants thereof. That wouldn't change my mind if there were aliens.
I think the Bible addresses UFOs, UAEs. Hugh Ross calls them RUFOs, residual UFOs. And if you read Ephesians 6:12, I'm sure most of you have, but for our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of the dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. To me, that fits precisely what UFOs, the behavior of UFOs, breaking all the rules of physics and doing strange things to people if these abductions are really true. You know, so that's a thought.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think every abduction story is not a good one. You don't ever see something good happening to these people. So, all right, Tim.
All right, we have an online question from Mark Wilburn, a couple actually. And some of these probably only Hugh can answer. The question is, the first one, what is the timeline for the moon forming event and the late heavy bombardment? So I believe the moon forming event happened when the Earth was very young, 4.5 billion years ago, and the Earth is 4.5 billion years old about. And the late heavy bombardment was about 500 million years later. He says, furthermore, how does this fit into the Genesis creation model, which is a great question. I would love to hear Hugh Ross try to answer that. And his follow-up question is, did Hugh explain the heavy bombardment as the result of Jupiter migrating inward toward the sun and then moving back to its current position?
I agree with you. I think those are questions for Hugh. So, Do you know the answer to the first one about when the moon? I think you're right about the moon forming event was about that time, but probably about 8:30. Sorry.
The moon forming event, I don't think, was related to the inward movement of the planets. It dealt with a second orbiting planet in the same orbit that the Earth has, Lagrange point, I think it's called. But eventually it moved out of that. It was a smaller planet than the Earth, and it collided with the Earth. Parts of the Earth were blown off, and parts of that planet, what was the name of it? Theta. And the debris that was blown away coalesced into the moon. So that's that. Why the other issue about planets migrating inward, there's a term for that too, and I can't remember what it is. Grand tack. Thank you, Robert. And very good. See, all together we make a good mind here. So help anytime you can. Here you go, Jamie.
I have a couple other questions. They might not make sense. How do you think multidimensionality might play in the UFO phenomena? I guess I was getting at, do you think they're from another dimension, which would be the heavenlies or whatever, like the principalities and powers, or are they from another planet? What are your thoughts on that? Is anybody okay with answering that? How do you think multidimensionality plays into the UFO phenomenon? Are they from another dimension? Are they like they indicate that Hugh indicates it might be demonic. They could be other physical entities from another planet. What do you think about that? What do you think the evidence says about it? Does anybody know?
I think we don't know.
He thinks we don't know. I think I don't know. That's for sure. So, okay. Any more questions online? Nothing else?
So we're talking about aliens being atmospheric, aerial, but what about aliens coming all the way down to the ground, and how many have stayed on the ground where people have seen it? I'm curious about that.
Three. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't really study UFO phenomena much, but so it's not my thing. But anyway, so any more questions? Anything? I guess we could probably wrap it. Shall we pray before we go?
Yeah.
Father God, we just thank you for your mercy and your grace. If it wasn't for your mercy, Lord, we would all be lost. And we love you and we thank you for it. We thank you for the freedom to ask questions that sometimes are outside of the pale. And you love us so much that we just ask you to enlighten us, enlighten our understanding, and we declare that even when we don't understand every detail, we know we can count on you. You are our rock, and we love you. And we thank you. Go with each of us this week. And help us as you always do. We love you. We praise you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks, everybody.